Where are we in Bible prophecy? I still find that question fascinating, and I will let you know where we are in Bible prophecy, by the way, before we're finished today. But I find that question fascinating as much as I did ever since I first learned there was such a thing as Bible prophecy, such a thing as the Bible revealing the future, which in the theology in which I had been brought up had never been talked about at all, ever. In the denomination in which I attended and grew up, mainly the basis of the teaching and the doctrine was the result of one man's refuting the doctrines and the supremacy of the Roman Catholic Church. So that's what I was taught, and not much else, and certainly not much else about the Bible. But I remember, and I can picture it today, still standing in the kitchen of my family home and talking to my mother, who had, in her life, had heard about Bible prophecy, but we hadn't been exposed to it and never were exposed to Bible prophecy until we were introduced to the Worldwide Church of God, and not through Mr. Armstrong, at least at first, but just in a peripheral way, but through my brother, who was studying the writings of the church at that time, and would come over and we would discuss the Bible and we would discuss the Bible prophecies that he was studying. That is, we would listen more than a discussion because we didn't know anything about Bible prophecy, but he was a great student and he was trying to teach us. And if we weren't responsive, he would get a little agitated and a little excited in his fervor and his zeal with the truth at that particular time. And so it was something that we would listen to for a while, he would be interested in, and he would be convicting. And it wasn't until a certain time in August of 1971 that it finally seemed to dawn on me for some reason. And I remember staying up one Saturday night and reading the book of Revelation, Unveiled at Last. And we have a similar booklet in publication now, but this one was written by Herbert Armstrong at that time. But Herbert Armstrong could have been Joe Smith, for all I knew. I didn't know any individual, but what I read was very interesting. And I stayed up all night and looked up the Bible passages, which I'd never done before and never really had studied the Bible. But through those years, in those early years, and I finally came along into the church, started attending in the fall of 1971, eventually baptized in January of 1972. In those days, sometimes we anticipated the answers or the answer, where are we in Bible prophecy, much to our chagrin to find out that we're not exactly where we thought we were in Bible prophecy. We thought we did, and there were a lot of good reasons for thinking that, for those of you that are younger that thought maybe this would be a crazy idea to assume that we are at a certain point. There were a lot of things that happened back in those years that would lead one to believe that we were much further along in terms of Bible prophecy than we were. And now it's 45 years later, and we still seem to be almost at that same place that we thought about in 1971, which is, we found, not really all that bad. It doesn't really matter all that much. So sometimes our anticipation, such as I remember in 1973, by that time I'd gone to Ambassador College. I was in Europe. I was in England in Ambassador College, going to the feast in Minehead in 1973, and the world was abuzz with the Yom Kippur War. And then the world was abuzz later with the oil crisis and all that occurred during that time. And certainly it seemed as though we were living in very perilous times. The only difficulty with being of that mindset and anticipating things before they're really ready is that sometimes you kind of lose out on all the good that might happen in society as well. And before you say, oh, there's nothing good happening in society, there were some good events that happened throughout that time, throughout these last 45, 46 years, that when my mindset was, you know, are we almost there? in terms of the fulfillment of end-time prophecies, and certainly it's a continuous thing that is constantly unfolding. We understand that. But sometimes you miss what might happen in the world that actually might be good, such as, well, I remember when it happened, but I kind of, to a certain extent, disregarded. And I'm not putting my experience in place of yours, because we might have different ways of looking at things. But now I look back and remember when President Reagan said, "Mr. Gorbachev, bring that wall down," it kind of slipped by me to a certain extent. I realized that, hey, that's a stunning proposal. And I meant to bring along the Good News magazine, because there are some really excellent prophetic articles by Vic Kubik about Russia, about Bible prophecy and everything. And I was just reading that as Terry's making dinner last night. I'm reading through that. We just got it yesterday. I'm looking through that and I'm thinking, wow, that's right. That was a significant event. And that was a long time ago. That was almost 30 years ago when he made that statement. And then just a few years after that time, the wall did come down and the Soviet Empire crumbled in a heap. And Mr. Kubik talks about that. And it's only been recently to where that empire is trying to reassemble, or at least Mother Russia is trying to reassemble those colonies that broke off. And now this is really significant. But in the meantime, a generation and a half almost has grown up without the domination of the Soviet bear. A generation and a half, maybe a generation and a half, have grown up in times of relative peace and prosperity and all that that holds. It's not perfect, and don't get me wrong, but sometimes if you are looking only from the standpoint of, okay, where are we in Bible prophecy? Remember, I'm going to come back. I'll nail it down for you before we get there, before we're finished today. We might miss out on good things that come along the way. So we're in the church. We're anticipating future events. Nothing wrong with that. I'm not saying that we shouldn't ask the question, where are we in Bible prophecy? I think we should. I think we should constantly prod ourselves. But there's a more important question that we can ask of ourselves as we look at what is happening in the world today and ponder the events of the future. So get the Good News magazine, by all means. I think it's really good. At least the parts that I've read so far really are very, very intriguing. Articles in a Good News magazine, our publications are hard-hitting. They touch on the things that are important today. They touch on things that affect people's lives. I know they help those that are not in the church. And there are a lot of topics that we can and should address regarding the changing morality of the world today and all that is happening in that way. And of course, that's been something of an assault since the 1960s, as many of you know. And it just continues to change and change and change and get worse and worse. Turn to the book of Genesis chapter 49 and verse 1. This is a pivotal prophecy. I don't have time to make a proof positive, and in fact, I don't think you can, of the identification in a modern way of all of these people. I think you can come really close, and we may have nailed it in terms of identifying all of these sons of Jacob. In fact, I think we have, but it's not enough to build your theology on. It's not enough to just say, okay, that's it. There's no more need to discuss the issue. But it helps us to understand where we are now in Bible prophecy. So I told you we'd get to that answer. So when we set the scene, the patriarch Jacob is near death. He calls all of his sons toward him, and he's going to tell them about the future. And Jacob called his sons and said, "Gather together that I may tell you what shall befall you in the last days." Did you get that? That's where we are in Bible prophecy. Close the book. We're done for today. This lesson is over. We are in the latter times. We are in the last days of mankind. The interesting thing is that we've been there for a long time now. We have been there for a long time. This chapter is referred to as by some by the blessings of Israel chapter. Chapter 28 of Deuteronomy, Moses outlines the blessings for obedience and the cursings for disobedience. He said that they would be punished seven times for their disobedience. And if you couple that with another passage in Deuteronomy, I think it's Deuteronomy 34 and verse 8, if you couple it with that, you find that there's a principle there that we have utilized a day for a year. And so when you consider seven times through an average year, 360, I'm not going to do all the calculations and all of the logic now. We've done that at other times. You come up with a figure of 2,520 years. And if you go to all the time of Israel when they were finally conquered and led away into captivity, you come up with the time period around 1800, thereabouts. And then, boom, on the scene, on the world scene, incredible expansion of power from two countries that were virtually nothing and not really thought of to be making those kinds of strides. Great Britain was great, powerful, dominant. How they, with a population of less than 30 million at the peak of their power, were able to reign through the entire earth and control vast portions of the earth and trade and sea gates and everything else is still a mystery to historians and scholars. And yet we know it happened. And how the United States kind of stumbled and bumbled its way into the Louisiana Purchase, the Gadsden Purchase, of which we are a part of, the purchase of Alaska, which was thought of to be a folly by the Secretary of State to purchase this worthless, barren tundra, Alaska. How crazy was that to purchase it from the Russians? And yet, we find that in this chapter, what was said to have happened in the latter days indeed had to happen to somebody. And the latter days shows that from the time of the 1800s, there are just so many blessings that are poured out. Now, rather than being just the blessings of all of Israel, the lion's share of those blessings is found with Joseph. And the sons of Joseph are the ones who receive those blessings in the previous chapter, Ephraim and Manasseh. And it says in verse 22 that Joseph is a fruitful bough by a well. His branches run over the wall. The archers have bitterly grieved him, shot at him, and hated him. But his bow remained in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob, or Israel, as his name was changed to. From there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel, by the God of your father who will help you, and by the Almighty who will bless you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lie beneath, blessings of the breast and of the womb, the blessings of your father have excelled the blessings of my ancestors. But it was contingent, all of this, upon obedience. God said that he would withhold these blessings unless they were obedient for seven times, or 2,520 days. Up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills they shall be on the head of Joseph, and the crown of the head of him who was separate from his brothers. Different. Separate. He was separate because he was sold into slavery at first, but then he was also separate because his blessings were much more bountiful than the rest. Now, we feel that through history, we have identified some of the rest of these peoples, some of the rest of these tribes. Issachar, for instance. Zebulun seems to be the Netherlands and the people of the Netherlands. You know, there's a prophecy. It says, he shall dwell by the haven of the sea. He shall become a haven of ships, and his border shall adjoin Sidon. Rotterdam happens to be one of the world's largest and greatest and most expansive ports, and they have, you know, sucked the sea away from them and built, you know, land from the sea itself. Reuben is mentioned as in the first part of the chapter in verse 3, the firstborn, the might, the beginning of strength, the excellence of dignity and the excellency of power, but unstable. for certain reasons. These traits seem to have been passed down through history. So Gad in verse 19, we seem to think that that tribe became the Swiss through history. So it's not a dogmatic teaching of the church. Where we come down to being more or less dogmatic is where and who Joseph is. And somebody had to possess these bountiful blessings that were passed down from Abraham, Isaac to Jacob, and so on and so forth. But he uses the interesting terminology that these things would happen to these folks, these tribes, in the last days, the latter days. And it's a phrase that is used throughout the Bible, and it's used in the New Testament as well as the Old Testament. The last days, shall I say, dare I say, have always intrigued God's people. We're always interested in when this might happen, but that's really, we've come to find that that's not really a concern. That's not that big a deal. That's not something that is absolutely necessary. There are things that are more necessary and more needful to God's people. We find, and we've, you know, throughout the time that you've been in the church, throughout the time that I spent in the early years in the church, we began to understand that much of Bible prophecy is concerned with the descendants of Jacob or Joseph. And we find that in the previous chapter of Genesis 48, that Jacob gave his name to those two sons, as I mentioned. And so in Bible prophecy, they are synonymous. Turn to the book of Judges in chapter 2, which concerns Israel, concerns all of Israel, all of the tribes as they entered into the land. God said that he would drive out these heathen peoples from the promised land. They had to do their part. It was kind of a partnership principle. You do your part, I'll do my part. They were to make an effort, and God would take care of the rest. And we know what happened, because they didn't do what they were told to in every case, and then they just suffered and suffered and suffered for hundreds of years because they didn't follow God's directions. So in Judges 2, it begins with a very interesting, I think it would be a very interesting scene from a movie if you could choreograph this properly and show exactly what happened, because an angel of God visits all of Israel and gives them some very direct condemnation. Then the angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, I led you up from Egypt and brought you to the land which I swore to your fathers. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall tear down their altars. But you have not obeyed my voice. Why have you done this? Therefore, I also said, I will not drive them out from before you, but they shall be thorns in your side, and their God shall be a snare to you. So it was, when the angel of the Lord spoke these words to all the people of Israel, that the people lifted up their voices and wept. Now, they were sorrowful. Now, you know, it's one thing to be sorrowful, but it's another thing to kind of change the pattern of life, and they didn't do that. They were sorry, but they didn't change their behavior, obviously. So you notice in the first chapter that, for instance, in verse 22 of Judges, it says, and the house of Joseph also went up against Bethel, and the Lord was with them. So far, so good. So the house of Joseph sent men to spy out Bethel. In verse 24, and when the spies saw a man coming out of the city, they said to him, please show us the entrance to the city, and we'll show you mercy. So he showed them the entrance to the city, and they struck the city with the edge of the sword, but they let the man and all his family go. And the man went to the land of the Hittites, built a city, and called its name Luz, which is his name to this day. However, Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shean and its villages, or Tanakh and its villages, or the inhabitants of Dor and its villages, or the inhabitants of Ilbeam and its villages, or the inhabitants of Megiddo and its villages. For the Canaanites were determined to dwell in that land. Well, they were determined. They were so determined to stay there. That means that Israel, Manasseh in this case, kind of gave up without trusting in God. And then verse 29, nor did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites. Verse 30, nor did Zebulun drive out the inhabitants. Verse 31, nor did Asher drive out the inhabitants. 33, nor did Naphtali. You get the picture. They halfway obeyed, which always leads to whole way failure. So then, because of that failure to trust in God and to obey him completely and all that he told them to do, though they did not do it properly under the leadership of Joshua for a while, they maintained the status quo. And it says in verse 7 of chapter 2, the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great works of the Lord which he had done for Israel. And verse 9, they buried Joshua, etc., etc. Verse 10 is where I'm getting to. When all that generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation arose after them who did not know the Lord nor the work which he had done for Israel. We see that even today in generational change, where parents, you know, fail to pass on the kind of lessons that they ought to pass on from one group to the next. Or we see the mistakes that they made because of the hardships they faced. Well, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to make that for my kids. That's never my dad's philosophy. My dad's philosophy was, I grew up in the Depression, and I'm going to make it seem as though you grew up in the Depression, too. 5 years old, you're not in school, go get a job. What do you think this is, a resort? Not quite that bad, but anyway, he did teach us a lot of good lessons. And so did my mother. And life was a struggle. It was always thought of being a struggle. That's the way it was kind of pounded into us from day one. So not a wholesale indictment of that great generation or anything, but that great generation was responsible for my generation of baby boomers who have had some colossal successes and maybe even more colossal failures and failing to pass on and teach appropriate lessons about morality to the rest. And then now we come to the biggest demographic, most influential demographic today, which is the millennials. And we'll see how that one pans out. I'm not going to pass judgment or talk about that at this point. But generational change is the theme of, is one of the themes of chapter 2. And you see this cycle that takes place. It's not a cycle that you often see within history, but you see this cycle of when Israel disobeyed, then God allowed their enemies to rise up and put them to tribute, and then the people would moan, complain, and wail, and God would eventually send a judge. And that judge would deliver the people, and the people would more or less follow that judge for a period of time till he died, and then the cycle repeats. Chapter 2 tells you what's going to happen in the rest of the book. And when a righteous judge is raised up by God, the people prosper as a result of it. In the same way in today's world, that happens with leadership. Mr. Kubik brings out an excellent point in the Good News Magazine articles about Russia that when a fairly decent leader came along in Gorbachev in the 80s and the early 90s, then the Russian bear changed and glasnost happened and perestroika happened. And they were reforms that happened within the Russian Empire. And they led to the tearing down of the Berlin Wall and that whole generation of people, several generations of people who had grown up as slaves of the Soviet Union, were finally freed of that burden. The Germanies were reunited again. And we thought, most of us, I'm pretty sure, thought at that particular time that that would be the spark. Germany is reunited. That would be the spark that ignites the powder keg. This German unification would be something that would propel Germany to be the leaders of a reunited Europe. But that hasn't happened yet. It eventually will. It'll probably happen not under those kinds of circumstances. It'll probably happen under very desperate circumstances, as it has historically through history, through despot, through difficult, powerful circumstances that have not yet arrived on the scene. So we see that people do follow their leaders, as Judges brings out. A nation's outcome is often determined by what its leaders do. And you could see that happen in just the not-too-distant history. What happened with Great Britain under Margaret Thatcher? What happened with the United States under Ronald Reagan? There were incredible times of prosperity and relative peace. So not mistake-free, don't get me wrong, but certainly it happened at that particular time. And what the future holds is what we'd all like to know, and we'd all like to answer that question, where are we in prophecy? And the only answer that we really have is we are in the latter times. But there's a more important question for each of us. It can be challenging to live in the times that you know were foretold thousands of years ago to happen. And many of you, I look out into the audience today, have been around for a long time. And you have been anticipating these things to happen for a very, very long time. Apparently, you've done a pretty good job of it, even through the years when we've had miscalculations and that sort of thing. And, you know, an anticipation over something that's going to happen, but it doesn't really ignite the world into kind of difficulties that we read about in Matthew 24. But the question I'd like to pose to you today is, how can you handle the last days? How can you handle the latter times? How can you handle living in the times of the end? In Matthew chapter 24, now that was a lengthy introduction. I'm halfway through the sermon, so realize that I won't be going on for another 50 minutes to after I've set this up. But Matthew 24, and in verse 45, it says, verse 44, I'll begin there. Therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. Who then is a faithful and wise servant whom his master made ruler over his household to give them food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. So doing the things that a servant who's been put in charge ought to be doing, and taking care of the household, and providing for the household, and making sure that every need is taken care of. A blessing is pronounced on that individual, and that's us, who will be found so doing at the time of the end. When you read about what's happening in the news, it can be very discouraging at times. Somebody came up to me and said, you know, I'm a news junkie and I pay attention to the news so much. There's a lot of it that is very, very discouraging that is happening in the world today. And you can't help but agree that that's certainly the case. When you find out what's happening, what's going on in the world, and you see this, how could this happen? And it seems as though I come to that frank astonishment more often than not in this day, and that it is getting steadily worse and worse as time goes on. I'm not trying to help you to be more anticipatory about world news, prophecy, and all that sort of thing. No, not in the least. But it is something that, you know, you can't help but see happen and be very, very sad about what is happening. Christ said that there would be a challenge to continue so doing as a faithful servant. And no wonder, because back in the beginning of the chapter, as the disciples said, you know, when will be the signs of your coming? He began to answer them in verse 4, and he said, take heed that no one deceives you. Deception might be one of the primary things to be aware of. For many will come in my name, saying, I'm the Christ, and will deceive many. And you'll hear of wars, rumors of wars. See that you're not troubled, for all these things must come to pass. Again, Mr. Kubik makes a great case for that happening as a result of the desire for Russian dominance once again that seems to be a part of that national psyche to regain that. And probably if you live there, you might, if you were nationalistic at all, you might say, yes, we need to recapture that. So people can develop a spirit of thinking that they're entitled to something and thinking that they should be. And that there's a lot of propaganda, as he mentions, that, you know, We know that those of us who are old enough, we remember in 1959 when Khrushchev came and it was on every TV set in America, all 60 million of them or that whatever it was, when he took his shoe off and pounded on the table, said, "We will bury you." And yeah, we know you would bury us. That's what, you know, we're afraid of. That's why we're building all these nuclear missiles too. We were scared of that. But they think the same thing of us. Now, we know it was true the way they had their attitude towards us, but in Russia, deep within Russia, as Mr. Kubik brings out, they have been led to believe that we aggressively want to stomp them out. All the while, you and I as church members know that the pride of our power is slowly being broken over the past 45 years, or even 60 years, 70 years, Korea, because victory has been redefined, you know, into a stalemate. When we defeated the Axis powers in World War II, there wasn't really any concern for civilian life. It was firebomb Dresden. If you've seen the pictures of that city after it was burnt, it was a smoking hulk of nothing left, no human life. That breaks the spirit of the enemy. Hiroshima, Nagasaki broke the spirit of the enemies into complete, absolute surrender. And so in the modern age, from the time of Korea onward, victory has been redefined by military leaders, and it's a different perspective altogether. And so the pride of our power, not the power itself is being broken, but the pride of our power is being broken, and that's an amazement to an American ear that somebody would think that we want to bomb them back into the Stone Age, because we have no such desire whatsoever. So Christ said that there would be deception, there would be wars, all kinds of conflicts around the globe, plus famines, pestilence, earthquakes, and that's only the beginning in verse 8. And then he went on to say, in a more personal way, it seems, to the disciples, they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you'll be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And many will be offended, will betray one another, and will hate one another. False prophets, again, here we see deception. This seems to affect the disciples of Christ in an even greater way and deceive many. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will wax cold. And this is what I would call the far side effect of society and the breakdown of society when people don't have respect for law or the institutions that are supposed to uphold law. The far side effect, as defined by me, is a cartoon that I may have told you about before, where two guys are in a fishing boat, and off in the distance 50 miles away, there's a mushroom cloud emerging over a distant city. And so they look around and one of them says, "Vern, do you know what that means?" And he says, "Yeah, there's no limits to what we can catch." In a farcical way, it explains the attitude when people are devoid of hope. When people see no reason for obedience, then the institutions to which they should be obedient are failing, and they decide that it is no value and it doesn't really matter. I don't have to be a good person anymore. I don't have to do this. I don't have to do that. I don't have to be held by these rigors of law. And that is what we see even happening today in the highest echelons of our society. Those to whom are supposed to be the upholders of law are the ones that are encouraging people towards more and more lawlessness. Now, I don't even think we've seen the tip of the iceberg. But he who endures to the end shall be saved. So how do you endure to the end? And how will you be saved? A pretty simple formula, which I'm going to show you today. Not points, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, do this, and you will be a better Christian. But nonetheless, pretty simple stuff. Turn to the book of 2 Peter. 2 Peter chapter 2, when you read through the several books, probably all the books of the New Testament, and I'll just single out a few of them today, when you look at these, you find that they realized that they were living in the latter days. Yep, they lived in the latter days as well, because Christ had already come once, and they knew he was poised to come back. So from that point, from the time of the crucifixion and the ascension to heaven, Christ was promised to come back. And they knew that, and you know that they knew that, and they understood that. And they didn't understand it fully until many days after the time of the crucifixion, obviously. But when you read through these chapters, they realize that the time of the end was in their lifetime. They probably really thought seriously that Christ would return within their lifetime, as many of us have done from the time that we came into the church, because we see all of these signs. And on top of that, we see things like Matthew 24 and verse 14, that there must be the potential for all flesh to be killed. There wasn't that then, but they didn't know that, and they didn't put that together back then as being an important factor. But we do. But they thought that there were that Christ's return was imminent. And in a sense, obviously, because they lived and died, their next waking moment will be the return of Jesus Christ, right? So chapter 2 and verse 1 of 2 Peter, "But there were also false prophets among the people, even as there will be false teachers among you, who will secretly bring in destructive heresies, even denying the Lord who bought them, and bring on themselves swift destruction." We have lived through a time very similar to that. In fact, exactly replicating that particular prophecy. And I'm not saying it's the only time it'll ever happen from between now and in the future. And although I don't encourage anyone to be suspicious of what is taught, as Mr. Armstrong said, believe what you read in your own Bible. But that means you have to be taught by somebody too, right? So you have to be discerning. You can't be just a dumb sheep. You have to be a smart sheep. You have to be wise as a serpent and harmless as a dove. And that's a difficult balance, because I have seen at times in the history of the church, back in the 70s, where brethren, my close friends, my brethren, were suspicious of everybody that mounted the pulpit. Every one of them were wrong, because there were some who betrayed the faith at that time. And it's always happened. You know, Paul warned the Ephesian elders about it in Acts 18 as well. So it's always something to keep in mind, but you know, you can't live your life as a suspicious person and look for a demon behind every single bush. Because if you do that, you're going to find one. And you're going to find that simple little innocent mistakes are translated in your own mind as heinous crimes of deception. So you see what I'm saying? It's that you have to be careful. We all have to be careful. But you've weathered the storm, at least most of you weathered the storm of heresy at least one time in your life. The vast majority of you sitting here today have done that. And I'm going to show you why you've been able to do that and why you were able to come out of that particular difficulty. But it says, "Many will follow their destructive ways, because of whom the way of truth will be blasphemed. By covetousness will they exploit you with deceptive words. For a long time their judgment has not been idle, and their destruction does not slumber." We can be sure of that, that God is going to seek his retribution. We do not have to. In chapter 3, Peter says, "Beloved, I now write to you this second epistle, in both of which I stir up your pure minds by way of reminder, that you may be mindful of the words which were spoken before by the holy prophets, and of the commandment of us." So Peter is doing, in the same way as he talks about Paul's letters taking on the same weight as the rest of the canon of the Bible, he is under inspiration of God, showing that his words of instruction are commands to be taken very seriously by the true brethren of God. And he equates that on the same level as the inspired Old Testament, as we call it. The apostles of the Lord and Savior are equated with the holy prophets of God. And in fact, that's the way it played out, right? Because it was their words which were written and recorded for the remainder of the Bible, the New Testament. Verse 3, knowing this first, that scoffers will come in the last days, walking according to their own lusts, and saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. For this they willfully forget that by the word of God the heavens were old, and the earth standing out of the water and in the water, by which the world that was then existed perished, being flooded with water. But the heavens and the earth, which are now preserved by the same word, are reserved for fire until the day of judgment and the perdition of ungodly men. But, beloved, do not forget this one thing, that with the Lord one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day. Another key, not rock-solid evidence in one sense, but in terms of the plan of God. If the days of the week are symbolic of the plan of God, and the seventh day is the day of rest, and the millennium is the 1,000 years of rest, then it goes to, you know, just the reason that there is a plan. And so we can know that we are living in the latter days and have for some time, and all of the friends that we know and have lived and died in the faith have lived in the latter days, and they await the resurrection if they've gone to sleep at this particular point. So the Lord is not slack concerning his promise, as some count slackness, but is long-suffering toward us, and not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. And in this verse, I take a key in terms of the anticipatory attitude that we have often had in terms of Bible prophecy, in terms of relating things that might happen in our society to a specific prophetic utterance, which it may or may not do. But the thing that we can be aware of is that this verse shows that as long as time continues, and until the time of Christ's return and intervention, and even then after that, in this age of man, before the dawn of the millennium comes, God just has more time to save more people or bring them to salvation, which is a very encouraging thing, which is what he wants. That's what he wants. He wants everyone in his family, and that's the way prophecy ends up, on a really great note. But in 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 13, Timothy is another book. The books of Timothy are like 2 Peter in the sense that it's clear that these men were teaching the brethren that they were living in the latter times. Okay? 2 Timothy chapter 3 and in verse 13 it says, but evil men and impostors will grow worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. And that's something that I think we can clearly say. I'm not saying we're at that point in prophecy, because, you know, that's very nebulous, because it doesn't give you a timeline at all. But it is an indication of what is happening and what can continue to happen within society, that Christ said the same thing, obviously, in Matthew 24, that lawlessness would abound and evil men and imposters grow worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. Because there's nothing there to stop it. I mean, the institutions that we once held in high regard are being assailed. Now, that ship could be righted, because we live in a political system in which that trend could reverse for a certain period of time. We don't know what the future in that holds. I mean, it looks pretty hopeless, you know, in that sense, that we could return to any kind of sense of normalcy. I'll grant you that. It could happen, though. It could happen. I'm not hoping or looking for anything. We're just kind of neutral observers watching as, you know, what happens unfold in the world. So, I mean, as a patriot, as an American, I guess I have my druthers, but you can't allow that to cloud your judgment in watching what happens in the world. But we can see this lawlessness and this trend towards lawlessness even from the highest levels, the highest leadership of society and from our country today. But here's the instruction that Paul gave Timothy, who was living in a time at least was parallel or similar to what you and I are experiencing. You must continue in the things which you have learned and been assured of, knowing from whom you have learned them, and that from childhood you have known the Holy Scriptures, which are able to make you wise for salvation through faith, which is in Christ Jesus. All Scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness, that the man of God may be complete, thoroughly equipped for every good work. Your job and what you are to do and what I am to do throughout the remainder of the age is to be thoroughly equipped for every good work. Matthew says that endurance is the key. But as I mentioned in a message several weeks ago, endurance isn't something you just get by just, okay, I'm going to endure. Endurance is something that comes with time. And your ability to endure comes with the patient exercise and the development of the inspiration of God within you in these vital areas. And that's how you are able, as an individual, that's how we'll all be able to handle the last days and the last time. Because as difficult and problematic as the world looks today, you know, I was coming out of an office the other day, and you know, we've experienced in Tucson some cooler weather, abnormally cool weather last week or so. And I thought, wow, what a beautiful day. I think it was Thursday. It was kind of cool outside in the morning. It was about 70 degrees, nice little breeze, not 100 yet, not 100. And then the next day's 100 and 100 and 100. And then you have to be thankful you don't live in Phoenix. Is anybody here that lives in Phoenix? Okay. Thankfully, you don't live in Phoenix where it's even hotter and hotter and hotter, and it doesn't seem to, they're 1,000 feet lower, so it doesn't seem to ever get cool in the summertime outside, and it doesn't. It just hangs there, that heat. And I remember when I had to work up there and stay overnight, I walk outside thinking, you know, when your lungs are burning because you're just simply inhaling air, that's not good. Okay, enough knocks on Phoenix. Do we have to stop? It's obvious, though, that the original apostles believed that they lived in the latter days. So the advice that their messages were filled with were not messages of go build the bomb shelter, go stock up on foodstuffs, go do this, go hide yourself in a mountain somewhere. They believed that Christ was going to return in their lifetime, and the instruction that you'll find in the books of Timothy and Peter are filled with the instruction that we need today. 1 Timothy chapter 4 in verse 1. How about this? The Spirit expressly says that in the latter times some will depart from the faith, giving heed to deceiving spirits and doctrines of demons. Now, maybe that happened in Paul's day, and maybe it's not going to be replicated exactly in the same way today. I don't know. But it says that, you know, if Christ says several times in Matthew 24 that deception is going to be a major problem and even posing a problem for the elect, then it stands to reason that, and Paul repeats it to Timothy, that, hey, we better pay attention to that. So just be on guard. Speaking lies in hypocrisy, having their own conscience seared with a hot iron, forbidding to marry and commanding to abstain from foods which God created to be received with thanksgiving by those who believe and know the truth. Now, part of that has, in a sense, already come true in the future from the perspective of Paul. It did happen. There was a large religious body that said, you know, that they should not marry. And I don't know of anything happening like that in the future or anybody that would preach that, but it could happen, I suppose, from a religious standpoint. And then I suppose abstaining from meats or foods, what does that mean for the future? We're not exactly told, but You know, vegetarianism is, you know, become a religion to some people, but, you know, it's not a religious expression that has taken hold. I mean, it's more of a lifestyle desire for the most part, and some of you may be vegetarians, which means that you're also kind of nuts, too, but no, I'm just kidding. Now, that's a choice, and more or less, that is a lifestyle choice. And I understand it from a dietary standpoint. That can be a very healthful choice for some people with some conditions. I've known people that, you know, they get their proteins from other vegetable sources and that sort of thing, and that's great. But, you know, they say that people who have, you know, very high cholesterol levels, fat content in their blood and that sort of thing, take on a vegetarian diet, and that seems to clear it up. So it may be, we're not talking about a religious thing here, right? We're just talking about something that somebody can do because that's what they want to do. More power to them. You know, it leaves more meat for the rest of us that, you know, you don't want your steak here. Let me help you with that. But going on, Paul told Timothy, if you instruct the brethren in these things, you will be a good minister of Jesus Christ, nourished in the words of faith and of the good doctrine which you have carefully followed. But reject profane and old wives' fables and exercise yourself toward godliness. Paul talks to Timothy in several instances in both of the books about fables. Now, I don't know of anyone here that has ever fallen for a fable from a religious standpoint or a, you know, we've got Aesop's fables that, you know, most of us are familiar with and we grew up learning. Now, this is talking about religious fables and injunctions that people ought to do that are just silly things when they're evaluated in the light of Scripture, but people make them into a big deal and turn them into must-dos in which they're just fanciful ideas. And they're the twigs of the tree. You know, the trunk of the tree for the Christian of God's church is the Sabbath, the commandments of God, all the commandments, not just the 10, but the things in which God clearly spells out our behavior as it's defined by law. The participation in the Sabbath and the holy days, that is the trunk of the tree. As long as you're grabbing onto that and not concerned about issues that are peripheral, not that they're not interesting, but if they're not clear commands, they could take on the effect of these things, where people put a lot of importance on things that really aren't in the long run all that important at all. 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 14, just half a page away, Paul said, "These things I write to you, though I come to you shortly. But if I'm delayed, I write so that you may know how you ought to conduct yourself in the house of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and the ground of the truth." It is the church which is the foundation and the supporting mechanism. It's you, the people of God's church, who are part of the temple, you're supporting yourself, you're supporting that mechanism, you're the ground of the truth. And without controversy, great is the mystery of godliness. The truth about godliness is that it's really pretty a simple thing once God opens up your mind. God was manifested in the flesh, justified in the spirit, seen by angels, preached among the Gentiles, received on in the world, received up in glory. And following through with that and understanding who God was and what he came for, as explained in the Scriptures, is the trunk of the tree and the thing that we focus on in our celebration of the faith of God. We want to know how we should conduct ourselves within the church of God. Because Paul believed that the end times would soon be coming, much of the instruction that he gave to Timothy can be summed up in chapter 6 and verses 11 and 12. "But you, O man of God, flee these things." And he mentions things like the love of money, which is a root of all kinds of evil. Some have strayed from the faith. "Flee these things, pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, gentleness." Not any great mystery here. You know, we have human beings, we're attracted to the mysterious. You know, one of my favorite movies about 8 or 10 years ago is, what was it, Nicolas Cage and American Treasure. National Treasure. Same thing. Picky, you too. What are you going to? Star Wars or Space Wars? Okay, Space Wars, all right. So, National Treasure, thank you very much for the correction. National Treasure held that one of the great secrets of the Founding Fathers was not this great document of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States and all of its amendments. No, the great secrets of those Founding Fathers were all the combined ancient treasures of Rome and Babylon and Egypt and Israel. And all of that gold is buried in some kind of ancient underground storehouse, warehouse, underneath Manhattan somewhere. And that's what the movie leads up to. It's a fanciful thing. It's very entertaining. Really enjoyed the movie. But that's not the truth of life. Life cannot be explained by mysteries. Christianity is not explained by some mysterious handshake or some kind of edifice that is around you right now, even in this room. Christianity is explained by doing what God says to do. And pretty simple stuff: godliness, faith, love, patience, gentleness. Fight the good fight of faith. How do you do it? With those previous things. Lay hold on eternal life, to which you were also called and have confessed the good confession in the presence of many witnesses. You'll note here that there's nothing here about a secret chart or a timetable or a timeline or understanding or knowing any of that stuff, which, although it may have its place, you don't have to coordinate some secret sequence of events to be saved, to gain salvation. You do have to live a good life. You do have to obey God, and you do have to repent, and you have to pray, and you study, and you read the book. 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 15. Be diligent to present yourself approved to God, a worker who does not need to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. But shun profane and idle babblings, for they'll increase to more ungodliness. Because they can lead to arguments, and they can lead to, you know, consternation. This is the second time he urges Timothy not to get caught up in what we might call the twigs, and not the trunk of the tree. And back to, if I read this already, let me double check. Okay, we read that one, 1 Timothy 4. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. 2 Thessalonians 2, we've read a lot of first part of this chapter many times about the coming of Jesus Christ. Again, it shows that that was something that was on their minds as it is on our minds. Don't be deceived, as it says in verse 3, there's a man of sin that has to be revealed, etc., etc. Now on to verse 13, but we are bound to give thanks to God always for you, brethren, beloved by the Lord, because God from the beginning chose you for salvation through sanctification by the Spirit and belief in the truth. It's very obvious in reading these two letters of the Thessalonians that Paul had a very deep admiration for these people. He visited them once on a journey, established the church, worked with them for a while, and then had to leave. And every so often he'd get letters and he'd hear reports from these people. And it's very obvious that he had a great deal of affection for them. And he gave them some simple instruction, just like he had given to Timothy. And he said in verse 13 of chapter 3, but as for you, brethren, do not grow weary in doing good or doing well, doing the right thing. Don't let anything stand between you and doing the right thing, the things that you ought to do. And now take a look at this, 1 Thessalonians chapter 3. You may not have ever seen this in this light before. Again, I said Paul had a great affection for them. And in verse 1 of chapter 3, it says, "Therefore, when we could no longer endure it, we thought it be good to be left in Athens alone. And we sent Timothy, our brother and minister of God, and our fellow laborer in the gospel of Christ, to establish you and encourage you concerning your faith." In verse 17, in the previous chapter, he had said, "But we, brethren, having been taken away from you for a short time in presence, not in heart, endeavored more eagerly to see your face with great desire. Therefore, we wanted to come to you, even I, Paul, time and again, but Satan hindered us. For what is our hope or joy or crown of rejoicing? It is not even you in the presence of our Lord Jesus Christ at his coming." They were thinking about it. They were thinking about the last days, the latter times, the latter days before Christ's return. He wanted to be with those people. He couldn't get there. But he sent Timothy, who is a minister. He wanted them to be established by Timothy, that in verse 3 of chapter 3, that no one should be shaken by these afflictions, for you yourselves know that we were appointed to this. For in fact, we told you before when we were with you that we would suffer tribulation just as it happened, and you know. For this reason, when I could no longer endure it, I sent to know your faith, lest by some means the tempter had tempted you and our labor might be in vain. But now that Timothy has come to us from you and brought us good news of your faith and love, and that you always have good remembrance of us, greatly desiring to see us as we also to see you. Therefore, brethren, in all our affliction and distress, we were comforted concerning you by your faith." Again, it was obvious that they knew that Christ would come sometime soon. In verse 5, or chapter 5 and verse 1, it says, "But concerning the times and season, brethren, you have no need that I write to you, for you yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night," and et cetera, with all the admonition that was given to them in that particular chapter. What this tells me is this: the instruction that Paul gave to Timothy in dealing with how to live in the last days is the exact same kind of instruction that he wanted the people in Thessalonica to get, because he sent Timothy, whom he had trained, to set that very example. So what worked for Timothy also worked for the Thessalonians, and as a matter of fact, will work for us as well. The Bible shows that there is a time of scoffing and lawlessness and deception and wars and rumors of wars. The time of Jacob's trouble, Jeremiah 37, is coming. By following the advice to Timothy, you can endure to the end.